The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 328 for Tuesday, May 3rd, 2011. Good greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you ask the questions, you send in your tips, we provide answers, we share our tips. Happily all learning more together about the Mac and Apple products. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
Here in Durham, New Hampshire, it's Pilot Pete.
That's
back
right.
Again. I tried not to make it today, but I'm here.
The forces conspired against you not to make it 5 minutes before the show is when I realized I didn't have a mic stand here for you. But we made one work, so. Yeah. And I'm hoping that the forces conspire to keep my throat happy throughout the show. My cold last week, plus a gig on Friday night, turned my throat into, well, something much less than useful, and that's why we've postponed a day here. I can actually talk today, so that's good. But we'll see how gravelly I get by the end. How are you, John?
Great, but enough jibber-jabber, because we got to conserve your voice here, Dave.
That's right. Well, you could jibber-jabber.
I shall.
We have a ton of great stuff to go through today. A lot of questions, a ton of tips, and then time permitting, I'm sure we'll have a couple of cool stuff found items to share with you as well. So before we get into Peter's question about what to do after power failures, I want to talk about our first sponsor for the show, which is Smile at smilesoftware.com. What we're talking about today is PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro. Now, in a very general sense, PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro are programs that let you create, edit, reorganize, and manipulate PDFs. Some examples that either one of these packages can do would be to paste a signature onto a PDF that you want to send back to someone. So if you have scanned your signature, or really even if you draw your signature on paper and you do a decent picture with your iPhone, that probably would be enough. Crop it down, move it onto your Mac, and then you could paste that into documents instead of having to print, sign, and then scan. Other things that you could do, if you've got a PDF which has text in it that you want to edit, PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro will actually let you edit that text. It's pretty cool. It's kind of scary because it's the sort of thing that you think, well, wait a minute, aren't PDFs always the way that they originated? No, you can edit them and you can correct things. Of course, you can also mark them up and put little stickies and notes and reorder them and delete pages and all of that. PDF Pen Pro adds a couple of features. One is the ability to create forms, fill-in forms. And another, which again is only in PDF Pen Pro, is the ability to convert HTML to PDFs. In fact, you can even take a whole website and convert it to a multi-page PDF with hyperlinks that'll work, and everything just kind of works inside it. It's very, very cool. Definitely worth checking out. Both PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro are available as a free trial from smilesoftware.com. When you're ready to buy, PDF Pen is $59.95 or $60 minus a nickel. And PDF Pen Pro is $100 and you get to save that same nickel. So they've got a 90-day money-back guarantee. You can find out about all of this at smilesoftware.com. But I do encourage you to go check out one or both of them, because PDF Pen Pro is one of the apps that I always make sure I have installed on my Mac. And with that, John, I think it's time to see what Peter has to say. So Peter writes, "We've all started up our Macs after a kernel panic or power failure, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about that too. There was a time that we Mac users were repeatedly warned that unless files were closed properly, bad things could happen. Has the journaled file system or anything else helped change that?" John?
Yes, maybe.
Okay. So,
here's my
That's
reply
a very
to Peter.
Definite maybe, it sounds.
A definite maybe. So here's my answer to Peter. journaling is, first off, there is a knowledge base article about journaling, HT2355. This is a feature that used to be in Mac OS X server and is now, of course, available when you format a disk. And I would say you should enable it. What journaling?
I think it's been around since Leopard, right? In the regular builds of Mac OS X, it's at least been 10.5 Leopard, perhaps even older than that.
According to Apple, since 10.3.
Okay.
It's been in the consumer grade and since 10.2.2 in Mac OS X server. What journaling does, and this is an option that you can select when you format a disk, and again, I think you should, because I don't see any downside other than perhaps consuming a little extra space, but I don't see any downside to journaling. But
it is on by default.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. As far as I know, I think you could format a disk without journaling. I don't see why you'd want to.
Right.
But here's what they say it does. So it basically, before, if your system crashed, then in order to ensure the integrity of the file system and the structure of what's on your disk, you'd have to run an operation that would basically tear through the entire disk and check everything out. And, you know, that's time consuming. Journaling, what it does is it makes note of significant events that occur with the file system. And if it detects that something has gone wrong, it will bring the file system into what they call a known good state. Though I'll say that with a caveat, because despite journaling, so to answer this question, journaling is good and journaling can certainly help. I mean, the nice benefit of journaling is that when you restart the system, rather than tearing through the hard drive saying, oh my gosh, something is wrong, I better tear through the whole disk and rebuild or verify it, it'll bring your system up a lot quicker.
It can start from a much more recent point than ground zero.
Right. And you may be asking yourself, how can I tell if journaling is being engaged? And
yeah.
I'll tell you.
How do you tell?
Well, if you look on the console, you will see a message from kernel. And I just did this on my MacBook because I just had this happen a couple of days ago, actually, on the second. So it was about a day ago when my system, I guess, locked up and I had to force a shutdown. And you'll see an entry saying replay_journal from and a big long number to and another big long number, which are these file system bookmarks, if you will. And then the last message I see is journal replay done. So at some point when my system crashed, I said, oh my gosh, I realized John's system has crashed. Let me bring the file system back to a good state.
Cool.
So my answer is that journaling can certainly help. However, I would not say that it prevents all problems. So to address his one question about saving files, as far as I know, most applications, for the most part, unless you enable an option and some apps have this, what you do is typically stored in RAM and is not committed to disk.
Right. So not all the time. That's right. By using a method or a function called write caching, right? The system stores some operations in RAM to make use of the disk more efficient and then writes it all out in batches.
Right. Now, one thing you can do, and I'll do this just force a habit when I'm working on a document, is I will typically manually save what I'm doing to make sure that at least at some point it's committed. And actually, some apps, I think Microsoft and probably some others, have a setting that says, you know, every few minutes. And I think there's even an add-on, I don't remember, that will force this to happen, where it'll force a save, which will transfer what's in memory to disk. But the thing is, even with journaling, and as we've seen, you know, journaling's been around for a while, and I've always had it enabled, I've still had problems with file system corruption. In that when I've crashed and run disk utility, it says, oh, something's wrong. So at least from what I've seen, Dave and Pete, journaling is not foolproof.
No.
So I would not count on journaling alone to assure the integrity of everything on your hard drive. Though it certainly helps. And again, as mentioned, it'll get you back up and running in a much better state than if you did not have journaling.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not sure what Peter's question specifically was. If it was more along the lines of, if my Mac has now suffered, if I've suffered a power failure and my Mac is off, is there anything I should do specifically before turning it on? And really, the answer is, if there have been problems, they've already happened. So yeah, go ahead and turn it back on. You'll see what state your system is in. to prevent against a power failure, I highly recommend something like a UPS, an uninterruptible power supply, or as it's commonly called, a battery backup. You can get these devices that you plug your computer into. Of course, if your computer is a laptop, it already has this functionality. But for desktops and the like, getting one of these battery backup units, especially this time of year where most of us, at least in the northern United States, begin, and I mean, in fact, all of the United States begin to suffer from thunderstorms. So, you know, power outages, short and long, are upon many of us. It's the time of year to have a battery backup for sure. So
let me go on and ask then, if you do either have to, something locks up and you have to hit the power button, turn it off, or you lose your power, what at a minimum are you going to do? Are you going to do a permissions repair and a...
Oh, well, more than that. Well, I would do a disk repair.
Yeah.
Well, both. No, what you're saying, yeah, permissions are... And, you know, I'd run permission repair on a regular basis because there always seems to be some permissions that just get munched up and they manifest themselves in mysterious ways sometimes when something's not working permissions. But I would do an actual disk repair, but booting from your system CD or DVD and running disk utility from that and doing or a utility like, you know, Drive Genius or I guess Disk Warrior or any of the other... Right. Cool kids on the block that do because the disk utility does a, you know, okay job, but it doesn't do an entirely thorough job. So that's the first thing. And actually, anytime.
Well, actually, I'm going to stop you there.
Stop me.
I agree with you that is the right thing to do. There's two things that I'm going to mention. Number one is you don't need another disk. You can do it from the command line if you hold down Command S while the drive boots. Assuming you can get to the command line there will be a command that'll teach you how to run FSCK, which is the system's file system check program. Now, here's something interesting. I thought Drive Genius has its own disk repair functionality built in, right? You can repair disks, you can verify disks, and you can also rebuild directories.
Yes, I've done that.
It's disk repair, near as I can tell, is nothing more than the same thing that Disk Utility runs. And there's a reason that I know this. This morning I got to my desk and my computer was acting. Yep.
I saw the picture of it and if you haven't seen it, so check Dave's, do you put that on TwitPic or Instagram?
I put it on Instagram. Yeah. But what you saw is
an indication of one of two things happening and hopefully it was the second and not the first.
Well, so I got to my desk and my computer was on because it always is. And there was a bit of it was just acting funky. And I thought, you know, let me reboot. So I'd go to restart. All the apps quit. The Finder quits. And I get to the blue screen where it normally kind of winds itself down before actually tripping the power restart, and starting it over. And it just kind of hung there. So I did what I always do, which is I got my iPhone out and I tried to get a terminal session in using the ISSH app and was denied, which meant that the system had shut down far enough such that it could not, that service wasn't available. I thought, well, if we've shut down that far, then really, I think we're probably safe enough and it doesn't matter if we are because it's the only option. I have to hold the power button for 10 seconds and turn it off. So I did that and I turned it back on and I got the Apple logo and then I got a progress bar underneath. Now this progress bar comes up when one of two things is happening. One is when it's doing a firmware update, which I know I wasn't doing. And the other is when the system has decided it needs to do its a file system check and it makes this decision on its own. And then it shows you the progress bar while it does that. Well, it didn't quite make it more than about 25% through the file system check when it just stopped. So I booted from my super duper clone and which meant it, which happens every night at 6:30 and last night's happened. So I booted from a clone that was as of 6:30 last night. And other than being a little slower, because of course the clone is a spindle drive and my main drive is an SSD, I was up and running pretty much exactly where I left my computer yesterday. So then I set about trying to check the drive and file system checks failed with invalid sibling links, which is something that I've never seen that particular message before. And so I ran Disk Utility to do a file system check. And then I ran Drive Genius because Disk Warrior failed to want to rebuild the directory there, which I knew was a bad sign. And while Drive Genius was running, not only did it give me exactly the same messages as Disk Utility, but I looked in the activity monitor and it was running FSCK underscore HFS, which is that particular software, the same one that you run from the command line or that Disk Utility runs. So so they definitely use Apple's stuff for repairs, but certainly not for rebuilds because Apple doesn't have a function for rebuilds. So right now I am in the process of yet again restoring my drive from its clone while we podcast. And I think my lesson to be learned is that when I do have to shut my system down, I need to remember to do a file system check on it afterwards because it's happened a couple times recently that I've had to turn things off in a funky way. And I'm sure that led to my demise here today because I was just lazy. So hopefully that's all it is, and I'll be back up and running. Run those file system checks. It's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anything else on this one?
No, I think we delivered more than we intended. On this one.
I wasn't even going to talk about my thing, and then you know when we got to this point, I thought, well, you know, we are here. Good to share a little anecdote. Because you don't want that to happen to you. All right. We have a caller, well, that perhaps has his own answer, but we'll get there.
Hi. I have a quick question about extensions. I was wondering if you guys had a program that you know of that will mass change extensions. So I have about batches of 8 files that I need to change the extension, and there's like 60 batches of 8 files that I need to change. So I have a folder which has a bunch of subfolders which has the files that I need to change. And I was wondering if there's a program that I could just, you know, put the program on and then it would go down and then change all the subfolders, like find the end of the folders and then rename those. Or I wouldn't mind even having to do it by hand, just like drag and drop type thing. Or if, I don't know, but something that will save me from typing DVD media or .DVD media over and over and over and over again. So thanks. This is where you cut me off.
All right. So we'll cut you off for now. So we got this call from him, John, and I started digging into it and I thought, well, gosh, you know, does the Unix move command work that way?
That was my thought too.
And unfortunately it doesn't because my thought was to use the Unix move command, which is MV, which is what you use for renaming from the command line. And typically it's MV space the name of the first file space the name of the second file. So I collected a folder of JPEG files and I said MV space star.jpg space star.jpeg. Right. So my goal was to rename all of the files that ended in JPG to ending in JPEG. But unfortunately, it only renamed the first one because it evaluates the asterisk and the asterisk means anything dot. And it evaluates that first before the command actually runs. So it's not sending that to the command. It's sending the result of that to the command. So the command got, you know, move first file.jpg to first file.jpeg. And it did that, but it only did one. So then I thought, well, let me see if somebody else has solved this problem. And Google led me to a Mac OS X hints article that talks about doing it on one line, but kind of iterating through and without, it's more complex than is worth explaining, so we'll simply link to it. But it is possible to do with a one-line operation from the terminal. And then, so I moved on. So I solved the question, right, John? And I moved on. And then, yet another call came in. Is there anything I should, you want to mention here before we start this next part of his thing?
I could mention a utility. I did see some of my Twitter folks asking this. I think our friend Peter was actually asking about this. And there is a utility called a Better Finder Rename.
$20
and it's and I think he had a similar problem. So, costs money. But this is something I think has been out for quite a while. So that's a commercial option.
Of course.
Again, a Better Finder Rename at publicspace.net.
Yeah, of course that'll do it. That's exactly what that thing's built to do. Very cool. And so our initial caller actually called back with this.
Hey, John. Hi, Dave. I had a question earlier about renaming extensions at like multiple files at once for extensions. And so if you wanted to change .jpeg to .pdf for some reason, you could, or .doc to .dox or what, so, you know, whatever you wanted. But I found an easy way using Automator online. And all that you do is you just create a workflow, and then you put in ask for finder items, and then at the bottom it says file types, and then you can do files and folders, which that's what I was doing because I had to rename a folder to a .dvd media. And then I check allow multiple selections, that way you can have more than one. And then all you have to do is go down to the go down and then grab from the side, side panel is rename finder items, and then you can select what you want, add text, but in this case we want you select name singular item, and then you can say base name only, full name, or extensions. We want extensions, and then two, and then in my case I wanted a .dvd media, and then it will rename the file that you select to .dvd media. In this case, .dvd media, if you're ripping DVDs, when you click on the folder that you renamed to .dvd media, it will actually open up in DVD player, which is really handy for those of whom have a massive ripped library on their hard drives. All right, and I guess I answered my own question there. All right, bye.
Thanks for the follow-up. So, yeah, that's yet another way to do it, using all the stuff that's built in and not having to go to the terminal. So, good stuff. Automator. Got to remember to use that more often. It is a handy little thing. Anything to add there?
Nothing.
All right. Moving on to Chris. And this might, I think this might rekindle some of our first conversation there, but in a different light. Chris writes, I purchased a copy of Microsoft Office for Mac 2011. If you aren't familiar with this program, I have not been able to save or open any file in Excel or Word since installing it. When doing save, I get the following error and it brings me back to the document. It says that is not a valid file name. Try one or more of the following. Check the path to make sure it was typed correctly. Select a file from the list of files and folders. When opening any file, I momentarily see a flash of text and was hoping to read that, and then it immediately goes to the same error as above. Excel cannot open this workbook. The file name contains invalid characters. None of these problems occur on my wife's 2008 MacBook Pro with the same most recent version of Snow Leopard installed. I can't figure out what the differences are, but I know there must be something. I've created a clean guest account and have the same problems. I have uninstalled and reinstalled. I used AppTrap to get rid of the other associated files, so I don't think anything was left behind after the uninstall. Other than that, I'm at a loss for how to troubleshoot this problem, and after hours and hours of searching, I haven't found anybody with a documented problem like this. I think the only other info I have is that PowerPoint works without a problem, both opening and saving. If it wasn't for the fact that I absolutely have to use MS Word twice a year, I would swear off Microsoft altogether. How can we help? All right. So I have an idea on this one, John. This is kind of funky, but I agree with Chris that something's different between his machine and his wife's, right? Because the same install of Word should work the same unless something else is different. When you format a hard drive, and we talked about that in our first question, you can do it with journal mode, but you also have the option, and this is not on by default, to format your hard drive as a case sensitive volume. And what that means is that lowercase a and uppercase a are treated as different characters. By default, Mac OS X runs case insensitive, which means that lowercase a and uppercase a are treated as the same character. And many pieces of software are written such that as soon as they are put on a case sensitive volume, they tend to break. I believe Photoshop is one of them. And it's possible that you might have this problem with Word 2011. I haven't tested it on a case sensitive drive. But that's the only thing I can think of. You try to guess to count. So obviously this is a system-wide problem, not a user-specific problem. If it is this, unfortunately, the only way to change it is to back up everything, reformat the disk, and in the process wipe it out, and then put everything back on. So it's not an easy solution. But if that's what it is, the way to test this would be to, can you do it with just a get info on the hard drive, John? I think if you go to the Finder and click on the hard drive, I think it'll tell you the format, and it will say case sensitive in the format section there. So that would be the way to do it. Other than that, I can't think of anything. Do you have any thoughts, John?
Yes.
Go.
I did a little searching online, and apparently this is a bug that was in early versions of Word 2011.
Oh.
So, yeah, this is not a valid file name. Try one or more of the following.
Yep.
Now, but this was a bug in opening, not save. He said saving, right?
He said saving in Word and both opening and saving in Excel.
Ooh. Okay. All right. I found a little article that talks about this bug in 2011. So make sure that run, I forget which menu it is in Word 2011, but I think if you, or go to the Mactopia site, you should be able to find something that'll get you up to the latest version. But yeah, apparently they had some difficulty with non-standard characters in file or special characters.
Okay.
So the non-alphanumeric. So, yeah, no, I did find this. I looked up the error message and someone confirmed that this was some bug in early versions.
Well, that might be it then.
Word 2011. No, but you make a good suggestion as well, because, yeah, some apps do suffer, I guess, from or get confused with, this format.
In a general sense, I would say you do not want to format case sensitive. The only thing I could think of where you'd want to do this is if you were setting up what's called a MAMP installation, where it's Mac Apache, MySQL, and PHP, and that's a riff on the LAMP acronym, which is Linux, Apache, MySQL, and PHP. Or if you're doing any other development that for stuff that eventually is going to work on Unix systems. The reason is that most other Unixes are case sensitive. And so if you want to write scripts or code on your Mac that it's going to work on Unix machines, if you're not case sensitive, you might run into some problem that you can't test for, on your Mac. So that's the only thing I can think of that would be a compelling reason to go case sensitive. But I don't know. You do more development than I. So I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that, John.
I've never formatted using case sensitive. Never found a reason to.
Right. Yeah. Right. All right. While we're talking about dead hard drives, Kent has a related question, especially for those of us that are not only Mac people, but I'll say DVR people in general, although his question is TiVo specific. It brings up a good point that hard drives aren't only in our computers. And Kent writes, as I was listening to Mac Geek Gab 326 and your discussion of hard drives and their inevitable failure, I was thinking about my TiVo hard drive, and I think it is experiencing a slow hard drive death. It started locking up and freezing and becomes unresponsive to any inputs from the remote. It doesn't seem to matter if I'm playing live TV or recorded, but I think that's all the same, and it basically is. Occasionally, the picture will shift from widescreen to a distorted 4:3 aspect ratio. Sometimes rebooting the TiVo will clear it up temporarily, but that's not a real fix. My question is this. From my searches, it looks like replacing a TiVo hard drive is no simple pop and replace. The sites I've seen tell you to mount the old and new drives into an available PC and run a bit of either Windows or Linux software to clone the drive. And, of course, make sure you disconnect your primary OS drive because you don't want to inadvertently trash that. Considering the fact that my only computers are a late 2008 aluminum MacBook and an old Toshiba Win XP laptop, this option seems not to be optimal. I'd love to upgrade the original drive to a 1 terabyte. I've found places that will set up a drive that can be a drop-in replacement, but they want a lot of money for this. I've got no problem paying for the service, but if I can do it myself, I'd rather. Okay, so two things. I'm gonna set this up, and then you'll take it over, John.
And I'm gonna knock it down.
There you go. So you're right. You do need to clone your old drive to your new drive, or at least have a drive that is set up for with the TiVo operating system, because the TiVo, like any computer, won't run unless it's got its operating system on it. So, but you can clone your TiVo drive. I've done it before. And back when I did it, I had to use a Linux machine for the reasons that he mentioned. This software was only available for Windows or Linux. And it worked okay. It was fine. Now, of course, his two computers are laptops, which makes this a little bit tougher because you can't mount drives inside them. They're not desktop machines, so you can't just hang drives off. You know, you don't need to buy cases and all that stuff when you're just going to hang the drives for a couple of hours while you clone it. But the newer tech universal drive adapter, it's what I think I don't have it in front of me, but it's like $30 or $35. And it's a USB device that just has adapters or plugs for all different kinds of, you know, serial ATA and regular ATA hard drives. Two of those would let you plug in two drives, and that way you're not buying two cases and it could work. So you, that's how you could get it plugged into your machine. Now, as far as doing it on your Mac, John, I'm going to leave that to you.
I'm going to take a little detour here, but I think it's useful because it's going to help him solve his problem.
Go.
Very quick detour. The TiVo, like many devices, has super secret little secret keystrokes that'll do cool things, but you got to know what they are. And I actually found a list here, and it's one group I think that is known for helping people with their TiVos, weak knees. And I think you may have, did you deal with them at one point or not? But they offer upgrades and other services. But there are these things known as TiVo Kickstart codes. And there is actually a code. So at least with the Series 3, and you may want to try this, Dave, or at least with the one that I have, and it varies, but they list all of these. What you can do is while the machine is starting up, if you and I think with ours, Dave, when you start it up, all the lights will come on. And then as soon as they turn off, you hold down the pause key and then you'll see the yellow light come on. And then at that point, you have about 10 seconds to type in one of several codes that'll make the TiVo do interesting things. And I think the one he wants to try is 54, which goes to a menu that gives you a number of hard drive tests,
right,
including a smart test and a whole bunch of others. So if he suspects that it's the hard drive, I would recommend doing that. So that's one thing. And actually, another thought, because I think I had this problem at one point, though it sounds like he has more problems than but I actually had a problem where the TiVo was not being very responsive.
Okay.
Replace the batteries in your remote.
Oh,
I have the same remote that you do. Yeah. No, just I doubt that. Well, you'll know if the TiVo is receiving the remote signal because most of them, or at least ours, the yellow light comes on whenever it's getting an infrared signal from the remote. But you and I both had the lit remote, Dave, which I found the batteries maybe every 6 months I got to replace them. So, but then here's what you want to do. So there is a utility that I think for the most part would run on a Linux machine or a PC, but it never seemed to get out. But I found a copy of it. It's called MFS Tool. And I think that's Minix file system tool.
Minix. Okay.
I actually, back when I was a wee lad doing my undergrad, Minix is a very minimal Unix-like operating system, and for whatever reason, their drive is in that format. But there is something called MFS tool, and I did find a link to a version that someone managed to compile. Now, I did go to the project page and downloaded it and tried to do the standard, you know, .configure and then make, and it wouldn't make on my Mac. That does have the development tools, and I didn't want to spend the time to figure out what the problem was. So I found a pre-compiled version, and as far as I know, MFS tool, and if he looks that up, he should be able to find enough info that will let him clone one drive to the other. The other thing that I read, now there is a command I haven't, and you're more the command line guru than I am, Dave, but I got indications that you could simply do this if you know the proper way to use the DD command.
DD. Oh, really? You can do that with Linux's disk duplicator, or Unix's disk duplicator, I guess. Huh.
So all I right. believe, so the Mac, I think if you, yeah, the biggest challenge, of course, is getting a connection so that you can, so your Mac can see these drives. But I think DD, it may not be the best way to do it. I think this MFS tool is probably better for doing this.
Right.
But between those two options. Yeah. So check the hard drive, even though the smart and the TiVo utility may still say it's okay. It probably is. And actually, I mean, you and I both have had ours for a while. I think, you know, now, of course, as soon as we talk about it, I'm going to go downstairs and it's kind of rolled over. I think I may want to pop mine open and do a backup of the...
That's not a bad idea.
Of the hard drive. Because yeah, pointed out...
Now that you've found this tool, it makes it, well, relatively easier. Yeah.
Yeah, because I think I have a drive. I don't even know how large that drive is. But yeah, since the warranty's over, there's no harm in opening the thing up now.
Yeah. 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 All right. And Matt has a question that is actually a little more timely given the Apple's announcement of iMacs, new iMacs this morning. But Matt, go.
Hi, guys. I've been considering buying a 13-inch MacBook Pro. To replace a Core 2 Duo MacBook that I have currently. The only difference seems to be the processors between the i5 and the i7. I'd be using it as an occasional desktop replacement and occasionally photo editing and video editing. Any help you guys give me would be great. I guess this is where you cut me off.
Right. And I will cut you off. So, John, what are your thoughts on this?
i7.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I think
megahertz, and why?
Because it's bigger than i5. No. And actually, I believe our own John wrote a little article about this, is that the i7, even with equivalent megahertz, I believe the i7 will give you better multi-threading performance. And since Matt said that he intends on this to, and the reason I would recommend this is because of the type of work he indicated he was doing. I think the video work especially, and I know from other podcasts that I've been on and people that do video work, is the more cores and the more efficient multi-threading is definitely an advantage when you're doing this heavy crunching for video production. So right. That would be my recommendation. I think a general recommendation is, you know, get as much as you can, but I think that's the main difference between the i5 and the i7 from a performance standpoint.
I think that's right. Yeah. It from what I understand, I believe that is correct. I would get as much processor as you can afford. You know, at that point, it's not a huge delta, right? But I guess percentage wise, it is a huge delta.
Yeah, but it helps the resale value as well.
It does help resale. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I would do the same thing with the, with the IMAX that came out today. I would definitely, you know, go ahead and get as much processor as you can. So good. Anything more on this one, John?
Nope.
All right. Let's, you know what? Let's move on to our tips and we'll get through those and see if we have time. I know we've got a couple more questions that we could do today, but we have a lot of great little tips and I want to make sure we get through those too. First though, I want to talk about our second sponsor for the show, which is Circus Ponies at circusponies.com with Notebook. This is an app that is likely familiar to longtime listeners of Geek Gab, and is actually a favorite of our own pilot Pete. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how you use Notebook?
There's nothing it won't do to keep and what's the word I'm looking for? Conglomerate your data, get it all into one place. Whether you're trying to keep PDFs, video files, audio files. Just take notes. You want to scribble notes in. Anything you want to scan in, obviously JPEG pictures, that sort of thing. Anything you want to bring into a notebook, just as if you're sitting in a classroom taking notes, you can do that as well. And then it has all kinds of cool things for you when you want to put it out. You can put it out into an HTML code and publish it as a web page. You can print it out as PDFs. You can just about any way you want to manipulate your and conglomerate your data, this is a program that'll do it for you. It's just as versatile as can be.
And you can search within it, too.
You can. That's right. Obviously, it's got tabs, and you can place extra tabs going, hey, there's an important note on this page, and click right to it. But any keyword, if you can think of one word on a page that you're looking for, then you type that in the search, and it'll find it. And if there's multiple occurrences, then it'll bring up every occurrence, but rather quickly find your data.
Right.
That's the beauty of this thing.
Right.
It's a wonderful program for managing data and all kinds of data and not just notes.
Right. So. Yeah. Yeah. Very, very cool. This is all available at circusponies.com. Now they have Circus Ponies Notebook for the Mac. They also have it for the iPad. And you can sync back and forth between, you can edit in both places. So you could presumably take if you were using a notebook for a class you were taking, you could take the notebook on your iPad with you to class, edit there, and then sync up when you get back home. So this is Circus Ponies Notebook. It is available from circusponies.com. At least the Mac version is. You can download a free trial of the Mac version, and that is then $49.95 to purchase after you check it out and love it. And if you're a student, and they've got a pretty loose and liberal definition of student there, so you can probably wind up, if you're involved at all, you can probably wind up getting that, and that saves you $20. Off the price, and for only $29.99 is the price that you will pay at the App Store for the iPad version. And you can find a link there, of course, from circusponies.com. So go ahead and check it out. If you think you can make it work for you, I bet you can. And with that, John, I think we move on to Clay. I heard you moving your mic stand around there, so I've brought you back in now, though. So. I muted you. I muted you for a bit while you were moving your mic stand around. So, Clay writes, lately, John has complained a few times that the iCal dock icon doesn't update the date automatically if iCal isn't opened. However, on my late 2008 MacBook Pro running 10.6.7, it does. John, I assume you've tried things like trashing the com.apple.ical.plist file and doing a kill all doc, which is from the terminal. That's kill all as one word, no spaces, space doc. And of course, doc doesn't matter if it is upper or lowercase because the system is running case insensitive.
I'm not sure about that.
Are you not sure about that? No, I think, you might be right. Actually, you might need to have doc capitalized in that sense because it's not a file system thing.
That's what I found.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you're right.
And so.
You're right. Right.
And so on my mini?
Yeah.
It's the third.
It is the third.
Yep. On my MacBook? It's the second.
No, it's the third.
Not according to my MacBook. I'll let you talk to my MacBook.
Okay.
MacBook Pro.
Okay.
But no, it did. It clobbered the dock. The dock went away. It came back. And on both machines, it had the correct date, whereas before neither one did.
Right.
But now the MacBook is slipping again. The other thing I tried, which someone suggested, was replace the dock icon. Get rid of it and replace it. And that worked for a little while, too. So it's a never-ending problem, at least on my MacBook. It's just annoying. Not that I look there for the date. I do not count on iCal to tell me what the date is.
And you have updated to 10.6.7?
Yep.
Have you filed a bug with Apple on this?
No.
You can. You're a registered developer.
Yeah.
Dude. Yeah. You'd be surprised how responsive they are about things like this. They'll probably have you test a couple things. Oh, maybe. Yeah, could be. Yeah, could be. But yeah, file a bug. I'd be curious if you may have a claim to fame in the next OS update if they fix it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've worked with them on some bugs with Apple Mail, not recently, but years ago, and they were very responsive through their bug tracker. So it is another benefit of being a developer is that you get to do that and actually have them, you know, potentially fix your problems if it truly is a bug. So a cool thing that I found while trying to solve a completely different problem, I actually was on the phone with tech support from somebody else, and they said, all right, we want to check through your console logs. And we want to look for just things that meet a certain criteria. And I said, oh, I know how to do a search. And they said, yeah, but you want to do something a little bit better. And this is actually really cool. If you're in console, which is in your applications utilities folder, and you go to the file menu, you can go to new database search and you can give the search a title. So, you know, if I'm searching for things that are time machine related, I might call it backup D because I know that I'm going to search for backup D. And then you can start adding to a list of criteria. So you can just have one piece of criteria if you want, but you can also say, look, I only want things that are coming from a certain program or from a certain host or, you know, after a certain time or before a certain time. And you can set all this up. And when you hit okay, you get not only a window that shows your search, but when you launch console again, you will see your search saved under the database searches heading at the top of the list on the left, which is pretty darn cool. Did you know about this, John?
No.
Handy. If you know, I am constantly finding myself diagnosing backup problems. And so, you know, I've created a search on my MacBook Pro. And while I was talking about the question here, I created a search on the iMac doing the same thing. Really, really handy. So something to bear in mind there, John.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good stuff. And it, you know, it's live, so it'll keep updating as new messages come in. Tends to work really, really well. So nice little tip that we found. Kirshen has a tip to share, John. Oh, of course I have Kirshen muted, don't I? You can't hear Kirshen. No one. I can't even hear Kirshen. Let's try that again. Kirshen, help.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Kirshen from freerangecoder.com with a comment about image editors that you featured in MacGeek Gap number 323. I personally use a product called Acorn from flyingmeat.com, and it's a image editor, something similar to Photoshop, but it's designed for ease of use, and it has three modes: free, paid, or trial. In fact, the author of the software believes that people should have a basic image editor and allows you to use Acorn completely free if you don't care about the advanced features. You can actually use it completely free. If you want to get it, it's $49.95 at flyingmeat.com, and I prefer that to Photoshop, in fact.
Wow.
Once again, keep on the podcast and we'll see you on the Bitstream. Bye.
Thanks, Kirshen.
Yeah, and I'll mention they just updated that. You can do all kinds of new things with it, including rotate and bend text, and it's a fabulous,
really
fabulous editor. Yeah,
I got to check that out. Yeah. All right,
I just like the name of the company. I mean, Flying Meat. Yeah. How could you not?
That's right. You have to use.
I mean, who doesn't love Flying Meat? Well, vegetarians, but
yeah. Well, yeah, that's right. Although, well, it depends on where
called,
it's flying.
It's called, but it's called Acorn. So that's cool.
That's right. Sometimes Pete flies meat if they pack it in the back.
I do. Sometimes it's still alive. And
yeah. Really?
Oh, my.
Well, really?
Occasionally, yeah. Huh. Fly horses and cattle.
Oh, I guess so. Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Wow. Things you never knew. Makes sense, though. Got to move them somehow. Claude, while we're on the subject of image editors, Claude writes, in MacGeekGab 310, John mentioned that Preview can open several PNG files at once, then save them as one PDF. This also works with multiple JPEGs as well, but not mixed JPEG and PNG. Mixed PNG and PDF will, however, work. While we're on the subject, here's another handy tip for Preview. Say you have some photos that you've downloaded from your camera to your computer, and you want to quickly crop and resize one of them so you can post it to, say, Facebook. Open the photo in Preview, click on the Select tool in the toolbar, click and drag on the photo to set up the part you want to crop. Go to the Edit menu and choose Copy. Go to the File menu and choose New from Clipboard. And the cropped area comes up in a new window. From the File menu, then choose Save As, select JPEG from the Format menu, or the Format pulldown, and then a slide bar appears that lets you adjust the resolution of the cropped image. Slide the marker to the left to decrease the size, and set it to whatever you desire. Give the image a name, click Save, and now you can upload it. So, nice way to crop photos while retaining their originals using just Preview, which is pretty darn good. Have you noticed that with Preview, when you've got an image on the clipboard, you can do the New from Clipboard in the File menu? It's a handy little trick.
Yeah, don't use Preview too often.
All right.
At least not for image editing, but
yeah,
good to know.
Yeah, it's limited. It's limited. All right. Two comments from MacGeekGab 326. The first is from, I think we have two comments from 326. There we do. The first is from Ahmad. He writes, in MacGeekGab 326, you were looking for a way to handle zip archives on iOS devices. There is an iOS app that handles zip as well as other archive files very nicely. It is called Filer, and it also has support for Dropbox. I use it a lot to download files from the web to my iOS device. The ability to download any file type to my iPad makes it a much more serious productivity tool. And I think it's just a couple of bucks, $2 or $3 in the App Store, and it works on both the iPad and the iPhone. So that's actually really cool, being able to unzip files and manage zip archives like that. I like it. Have you tried Filer, John? Are you? I thought that might be one of those few apps that you've actually gone in.
I don't really deal with zip files. I don't deal with zip files on my iPhone.
The iPhone is less functional in that sense than the iPad is. You know, the iPad, there's definitely been a couple of times where it's like, oh man, I want to be able to get at that file. So thank you, Aman. That's awesome to know about that.
I mean, it is weird because, you know, at least in Mac OS X, there is the zip command is built in. So,
right. And I'm sure it's, I wonder if it's built in on the iPad. Huh. I'll have to check one of the devices that we have jailbroken here and go to the terminal and see.
Oh, okay.
That'd
be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting. It's similar to that story. From 326, Allison Sheridan from NozillaCast, which is at podfeet.com, writes, Dave, after hearing of your travel woes, I tested out the idea of connecting the iPad USB connection kit to a USB to Ethernet adapter to see if the iPad would accept a wired Ethernet connection. I bought my husband the USB Ethernet adapter after he traveled with his MacBook Air and ended up in the same predicament of only having wired Ethernet. In any event, it doesn't work. As soon as you add the USB Ethernet adapter to the camera connection kit, a warning comes up on the screen saying it isn't supported. Undaunted, I put the iPad in airplane mode and plugged in an Ethernet cable, and sure enough, couldn't get online. So, yeah, there is no Ethernet network stack. Yeah. It's too bad.
How else is Apple going to sell Airport Expresses?
even that, you can't configure it from the iPad. Right? You're stuck if you're in a hotel room.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, you'd have to pre-configure it at home.
Yeah, but I mean, once it's done, I mean, I carry mine and frequently
once it's
don't.
Done.
Yeah, I've done it. Well, I'm trying to think. Yeah, you can configure it at home.
Yeah.
Now, once it's done, there's frequently times when I never pull out the laptop. I plug in the Airport Express and then go using my iPad.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, but
whatever
if you
happened
had
to this,
reconfigure,
yeah. Whatever happened to it just works.
Well, it does just work as long as you're set up exactly right.
As long as you pre-configure.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, this is an interesting little thing that, you know, we've got these devices that are in many ways laptop replacements for certain types of traveling. And
you know, and for what they charge you, the hotels need to get on board with providing decent internet. But I know that's a whole nother big soapbox we probably don't want to build and stand on right now.
That's right.
But
yeah, it's crazy, man. All right. Well, we are, as I anticipated, we are running out of time. So let's do a couple of these cool things found here, John, and then get on. And you have one to add. Did you tell me that at the beginning of the show?
Yes, I do. But you know, their page is, tell you what, I'll tell you because I have downloaded it, but it's called KISSMAC, KISMAC. And it is best way to describe it. So it's not only a wireless networking tool. Let's put it that way. But it does things that other tools do not. One thing it'll do is that it supports, I believe it's called passive mode. The practical offshoot is that you can detect more base stations, including ones that are supposedly hidden.
Huh.
So you can find those. If you do find a base station that is open and you click on it, it'll show you all of the connected devices, which can be quite entertaining.
Huh.
And also for networks that use weak encryption, such as WEP, you can use it to collect data or prod it and perhaps even crack the key only for educational purposes only, of course.
Of course. Really?
It has a sordid history because if you go to the original webpage for it, kismac.de,
yeah, well,
which is Deutschland or Germany.
Yeah.
Well, apparently Germany a little while ago made this sort of software illegal.
Oh.
So, and the thing is they moved it to another website, which for some reason now, maybe these guys shut down too, kismac-ng.org.
Yep.
And that's not responding right now, but I found it in a couple of other places.
Me.
Oh, okay. Something's wrong with my connection. Yeah, kismac-ng.org.
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
Good.
Yeah, I'm able to surf around, no problem.
Sweet. Okay, so it's still available.
Yes.
So they haven't shut it down.
No. Which is
but
good.
I thought it was neat. The probably the most useful feature, again, was the being able to click on an unprotected base station and see all of the devices connected to it.
Yep.
Really neat. And I suppose you could use it to diagnose your own your network as well.
I like that. That's awesome. All right. Everett has one. Go.
Hi, John. Hi, Dave. I am calling to put something into the Cool Stuff Founds bin. It's a Just Mobile Gum Plus is what it's called. And it's a battery pack. And it has a USB mini on one side that you plug into the computer for it to charge. And then a USB port on the other side for you to plug your desired device into to charge. It's 4,000 mAh, I forgot what that stands for, but it will charge my iPod Touch 6 times. It says on the box it will charge it 4 times, but I have experienced it with 6.
Wow.
It will charge, it says it also charges the iPhone 4 times, and then it's been working really well for me, and yeah.
Cool.
So, sleek design, very... very portable, so I just wanted to let you guys know about this.
Thanks, Everett. That's with summer coming up and camping trips and traveling and all of that stuff, I can see having one of those be a really handy thing to have around to keep your phone charged or really your iPad or iPod or whatever. That's what a smart idea to give you more juice than you need.
MAH, of course, being milliamp hours, which is common way to measure battery capacity.
Yep.
And yeah, that's way beyond. I forget what the iPhone itself has.
It's 1600, 1500.
Yeah.
Like
okay. So,
I think
yeah. So that's great.
Yep. Or maybe it's 1200. in the iPhone. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I mean, that's a pretty hefty,
whatever it is. Mine's weak.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. This is more better. Yeah. So, you'd hang it in your tent and charge overnight, just like you do when you're at home. That's pretty cool. Something I wanted to mention a couple of weeks ago, but their app through an app store renewal snafu had been, it was down the day we were doing the Cool Stuff Found show. But I wanted to resurrect it now that their app is back in, is, an app called Awareness, the headphone app from the company Essency. And it is available in the store. I think it's like $2. The idea is, and this actually solves a problem for me. You know, a lot of times I'll be on an airplane watching a movie, but, you know, so I'm not plugged in. I'm watching it on my iPad or iPod or whatever. So I'm not plugged into the plane's audio system watching a movie. Now, the one benefit to being plugged into the plane's audio system when watching the movie is if the crew or captain needs to make an announcement, I hear it. Whereas if I...
That's a benefit.
Well, it can be.
Well, it can be. That's true.
There are times when I want to know what is being said around me and times when I don't. Right. But, right. You know, especially if we're getting close to landing, I don't want to miss the announcement and, you know, whatever. You know, sometimes I want to know. So what this app does is it sits in the background and you configure it to it listens to your microphone, but you configure a threshold. And when sound hits that threshold, it lets the sound from your microphone into your ears. So you could not only use this in the example I talked about, but, you know, if you're out walking or riding your bike, I mean, I don't know how disconnected from the world you want to be riding your bike, but this could let that happen. And again, it's like I said, I think it's a couple of bucks. And then they've got some add-ons, which I haven't tested yet. I did test the app and it totally works. The add-ons I haven't tested, and they're like, it'll duck your iPod volume or pause your iPod, I think is one of the add-ons so that you don't miss anything while hearing sound from, you know, the people blathering at you. But I think it's got another add-on where it'll automatically, readjust the gain or the threshold to the ambient noise around you. So if you're moving perhaps on a bike and you're moving through different environments, it'll constantly readjust for you. So it's pretty cool. It's a pretty smart idea. And it's amazing that it actually works. You know, it's one of those things that'd be like, if only you could have enough access to the system to make this work. And apparently you can. So any thoughts on that, John?
Nope.
Okay. Let's do one more. We'll wrap this up with one from listener Michael. Michael didn't write anything. That's why I can't find the email. Michael, I believe tweeted us about something called Jump Desktop at jumpdesktop.com. Now, what this is it is a remote desktop app, for the iPhone and iPod and all of that stuff. Have we talked about this before? I feel like we've talked about this on the show before. Do you know about this, Pete?
I don't.
Okay, then we haven't talked about it on the show. We'll let Pete be the voice of the listener. Maybe we prepped it in the past.
Looks like it has something to do with the eye devices.
It does. No, what it does is it allows you to control your computer from your iPad or iPhone or iPod Touch, but you can connect it via the HDMI or the any of the video out connectors. You can connect it to a real monitor. So you can connect to a real monitor. You can, of course, use a Bluetooth keyboard. And now your iPod or I mean, certainly your iPod, but even your iPad becomes this device that you're not using its screen. You're just letting it be the gateway to controlling your home computer, either Windows or Mac. It'll do remote desktop or VNC, which is, of course, compatible with the Mac. So very, very cool. Very, very cool stuff. And we did talk about it, John. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
No, I see it in the meticulously and lovingly handcrafted show notes.
So why didn't you interrupt me and tell me?
I did.
Oh, well, you interrupted me on Skype. You can interrupt me here so the listeners hear.
Well, all I have is in the show notes. I don't know how much we talked about it. So,
I think we talked about it before. All right. Well, we can't end on that. If we can't end on a rerun, that's not a good way to end. We got to do Google Apps. Oh yeah, Pete, go.
Yeah. Google Apps. If you've ever considered it, I got an email from Google this week, and on May 10th, they are cutting off the 50 free users on a Google Apps account. They're bringing it down to 10. They will, however, grandfather you in. So you've ever even thought you might want a Google Apps account, tie a domain name to it, do it now and then just park it. You can go back and configure it later if you want. But having the ability to go to 50 free users sounds much more versatile than 10 free users, which is what it's going to be shortly. After that, it'll be after those number of users, it's a paid upgrade. So I have domain name for each of my kids. And so I just threw their Google app account together. And it's much more than Gmail. I mean, it ties all your calendar and your Gmail and your documents and your website, if you want to host it there, ties it all in, and it doesn't appear to be from Gmail or from Google. You use that domain name that you own, or lease, I should say, and Google Apps is pretty amazing and versatile. You use it here, don't you, Dave?
Yeah, I do.
You use a business account.
That's right. Yeah, no, it's great.
It's very powerful, configurable.
Yeah. Yeah, very, very handy.
So do it before the 10th if you want to at least lock in more users than 10.
Right. Good. May cool. 10th. All right. So we'll do one more from Corey because this is actually cool. And that's why we include it. Corey writes, not sure if you guys have heard about this yet, but I found this online a couple of weeks ago and have been using it all the time. If you need to share a file with someone, sure, you can use Dropbox and a public link, but that can be a pain. With Cloud App at getcloudapp.com, you just drag the file you want to share up to the menu bar and it uploads. A link is copied to your clipboard, which you can then paste anywhere, and now anyone can download it. Perfect for sending larger files over email, which, let's be serious, wasn't designed for sending files anyway. Lots of neat plugins and such too, which make it even more useful. So yeah, check it out. Getcloudapp.com is the place. I like that. I'm going to have to start using that one. Just drag it up, paste it in, go. Have you ever used that, John?
Have not.
Have not.
Interesting.
Anything else?
Cool stuff.
So the other person doesn't have to be a like a Dropbox user to share it. Oh, yeah. That's beautiful. Okay.
Yeah. Cool stuff or anything before we wrap this one up and move on with our weeks.
Well, a new feature in the iFi card that I just activated today. It was going to be maybe part of a quick. Well, iFi has a direct mode now. You can go from your iFi camera card directly into your iDevice, which I think is kind of cool. Yeah, it's only the X2, I believe the X2 series of iFi products.
Okay.
But yeah, so they've updated their iDevice app, and also you have to do a firmware update on the card. But this is kind of nice. So it puts it in the same area. I'm just experimenting with it, but it's I think a feature that may prove handy for people if you want to take what's in your camera and put it on your iDevice, and then use any of the programs you have on your iDevice, Instagram or something like that, to share your photos.
Yeah.
So I think that's pretty slick.
That's slick. I like it. All right. Let's see. Well, if you have a question or a tip or cool stuff found or a question, you can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which John is
4335.
That's right. Any
else? Could they email us at feedback@macgeekgab.com?
No, Pete. They can email us, but it's feedback@macgeekgab.com.
It's certainly not feedback@macgeekgab.com.
I'm sorry.
Don't send it there.
I can't remember.
You can see the show notes at macgeekgab.com. You can also Skype your comments into MacGeekGab. You can leave us comments on iTunes, to which we cannot respond, but they do help us. They do help promote the show, and promoting the show is good for you because it keeps us going, and that's, you know, that's a good thing. And plus, it increases the knowledge pool. John and I certainly don't have the answers to everything. We do our darndest, but occasionally we do present a question that we don't have the answer for, or we present an answer and there's a better one out there. We are more than happy to share that, and that's why it's good to have lots and lots of you listening. So thank you for all that you do, folks. Have anything else to add, John?
I think that's about it.
Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast converts this to AAC for you. Cashfly.com provides all of the bandwidth. The podcast marketplace includes the A5 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo from Barebound Software, PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro from Smile, and Notebook from Circus Ponies, all through Backbeat Media. And that's it. My voice held out better than I thought it would, John.
Nice.
Yeah, that's a good thing.